cows have produced to feed the baby, right? So what's the intention there from nature? It's intended to grow a calf from, you know, 60 pounds to 400 pounds very quickly.
Hello, and welcome to the Plant Prescription Podcast. This podcast is all about helping you live a longer, happier, and healthier life. We will be featuring conversations with great minds to inspire you to reach your ultimate potential. My name is Muzammil Ahmed. I'm a medical student with a master's in psychology, certification in nutrition, and a bachelor's in business.
And my name is Cass Warbeck. I'm a medical student with a bachelor of science in health and fitness physiology, and I'm also a plant-fueled Muay Thai fighter. We are both plant-based lifestyle advocates who are passionate about spreading positivity, optimizing health, and promoting sustainability. Hello, everyone. Our guest today is Vivian Chen, an integrative health practitioner who truly believes that food is medicine. Doctors these days have a pill for every ill, and although Western medicine is incredible and can be life-saving, it is also important to address the underlying issues of disease instead of merely covering up the symptoms. Vivian trained as a doctor in the UK, practicing as a family physician. Her own struggles with health and well-being led her to discover the power of food and the role of lifestyle medicine in disease prevention and treatment.
These days, Vivian runs her own company, Plateful Health, where she helps her clients take back their health and live the life that they deserve. Vivian is especially passionate about raising awareness of the negative health effects of dairy, and we took this opportunity to take a deep dive into this topic. We hope that this single conversation will answer all your burning questions and inspire you to leave the milk and cheese off your plate for good. Please share this conversation with anyone who needs to hear this message. And as always, if you value the work we're doing, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, as this helps more people find our show. Thank you and enjoy. Hello, Dr. Chen. Thank you for coming on our podcast. We're excited to discuss everything dairy. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me. You guys are doing such great work changing the landscape of medical education. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. So Dr. Chen, it would be really good to start with how you realized the not so talked about negatives of dairy.
Yeah, so it's really funny because all through medical school and even when I practiced as an internist and family physician back in the UK, I always told my patients to consume lots of dairy because it's good for bones. And it wasn't until I had my daughter that everything turned around for me and I started to question the entrenched idea that dairy is good for us. So when my daughter was about 4 weeks, she started to have trouble feeding. So she developed this aversion to breastfeeding. She would feed for a little while and then she would come off, arch her back and cry in pain. And, you know, when a baby presents like that, typically doctors say they have reflux because, you know, that's kind of the diagnostic symptomatology. So she was diagnosed with reflux. She also had a lot of colic, so she was crying a lot. And again, the doctor said that's normal because babies have immature digestive tract and, you know, just to kind of hang in there. We tried several different things. She was put on antacid medications. It didn't work and things really escalated and got worse until she actually stopped feeding and got really dehydrated. And she had to be hospitalized and tube fed. So she was fed by NG. Just to basically keep her alive. And as you can imagine, as a mom and as a mom who's a doctor, the kind of despair that I felt. So I basically dived into the research to try and find, the reason why she's not feeding, because the doctors, the pediatricians, the family physicians, everyone who was looking after her really didn't have a clue. She, at that point, already had a pH study. So that's a study where you put a probe down into the stomach to see whether she actually had reflux, and it showed that she didn't have reflux. So everything we had kind of presumed she had up to that point was incorrect, but we were still left with the question why she wasn't feeding. So at that point, a friend of mine, who's also a doctor, whose mom is a pediatrician, said that I should probably look into the possibility of cow's milk protein allergy. And so I dug into the research and I came across these papers from 1980s, basically documenting symptoms that, you know, resembled hers. So the aversion to feeding and, you know, the colic. And so I persuaded her pediatrician to try her on a hydrolyzed formula, because I was breastfeeding her at the time, and calcium milk protein can actually be transferred through breast milk. And so at that point, the situation was so desperate, I really didn't have time to kind of eliminate dairy from my own diet, because it takes up to 3 weeks for dairy protein to come out of my breast milk. And so we tried the hypoallergenic formula, and she improved within 2 weeks. So that was kind of the diagnosis. And then later on, when she was better, we retried dairy, and again, she had pain. So that was the diagnosis made. And from that point, I kind of was thinking to myself, what have I missed from my medical education? You know, I was a doctor who was already very experienced and had gone through medical school, and I was not able to help my child, and neither were the other doctors involved. So there's a big chunk of information that's missing, if that's the case. And so I had basically developed an interest in nutrition from that point.
Wow. I can't even imagine, as a mother, having to go through that, that you have the medical expertise and yet you're not able to help your own baby girl, because it's just not making sense based on what you've been taught
throughout the medical curriculum. It's heartbreaking. And I think nothing shakes you more than, you know, something like that, that turns your world completely upside down. And so I started to question the medical paradigm and what I was taught in medical school. You know, if the papers were from 1980, so why was it not in medical textbooks? I know it can take, I don't know, something between 7 to 17 years for medical research to get into medical education, but it had been far more than that between those papers and, you know, what I experienced. So I realized I needed to do a lot more learning, and that's when I started my very steep learning curve.
It's hard to believe that there's such a lag between the research, but it's sad because it's still going on today. Like, they're still not teaching this in medical school, and that's part of why we're trying to get this information out there.
So that's why I really admire the work you guys are doing, because it's so needed. I think there's a lot of pushback on the truth getting out, and there's a lot of industry interests trying to prevent the truth getting out. So, yeah.
Yeah, well,
I agree with you.
I was going to say, we're super excited in Canada here because, like, say, with our new 2019, the new food guide that came out, they actually dropped dairy as a food group. So we're making progress, and hopefully some other countries continue to follow suit.
I was so happy when I saw that.
Unfortunately, it hasn't been incorporated in the medical curriculum, because a lot of the dietitians still talk about the benefits of dairy and don't like the fact that it was dropped out of the food guide. But I think so it still needs a lot more education. To get the medical curriculum to be updated, as well as like the dietitians to realize like why the Canadian Food Guide did this. So I have a question for you. This seems to be a common question. What's the difference between dairy allergy and lactose intolerance?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of people misunderstand that there's actually a big difference between the two. So lactose intolerance is more like an intolerance. So it's basically not an immune mediated process. It's a lack of enzyme. So an intolerance is where your body cannot digest or process the food, and you start to exhibit symptoms after ingesting it. So in the case of lactose intolerance, you're lacking the enzyme lactase, which actually the majority of human population lack after we wean. And that's actually a natural progression, because we have this enzyme lactase to be able to digest our mother's milk. And then when we enter into toddlerhood, you know, after the age of 5, really, we don't need this enzyme anymore. So when we lack this enzyme and we ingest a food that contains lactose, then two things happen. One, this lactose can draw water into the abdomen, and then it passes undigested into the large intestine. So if you have lactase enzyme in your small intestine, the lactase breaks down lactose and that doesn't happen. But if you don't have the enzyme, the lactose actually passes through into the large intestine where it's fermented by the bacteria there. And then you get the symptoms. So a lot of people can have symptoms like bloating, discomfort, diarrhea, and those are the common symptoms of lactose intolerance. There's variation in the level of population that's lactose intolerant in different races. So for example, for me and Asians, 95% of us are lactose intolerant. We wow. don't have that enzyme. Whereas there are some European populations where they do retain that enzyme. Now, milk allergy is completely different though. And very often it's actually an immune-based attack on the protein. So lactose is a sugar in milk, but the allergy is an attack on the protein that's in the milk. And the consequences are often a lot more severe. And if you have anaphylactic type reaction to cow's milk protein, you can actually, you know, potentially die. It's very serious. So, but again, the range of symptoms there can vary a lot depending on the type of allergy you have. So even within an immune response, it could be an IgE based. So I always liked to say IgE stands for immediate. So that's your immediate attack where you can have, you know, lip swelling, throat swelling, and that's where you know, in the severe form may lead to anaphylaxis. And then you've got the non-IgE mediated allergy where you've got the delayed reaction. So you may not see a reaction immediately, but the symptoms are a lot more insidious and a lot difficult to pick up. And this is where we really mainly run into trouble with dairy allergy, because people are not putting two and two together, because there's not that, you know, immediate temporal relationship. But very often in practice, we see things like reflux, colic, constipation, eczema. There's so many different aspects that can come out from non-IgE mediated allergy. So it's definitely something that needs to be taught better at medical school, because I think doctors are not yet quite able to make the diagnosis confidently.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And how you described it was super educational. How prevalent is lactose intolerance, like if you were to give a percentage?
Well, I think it's estimated around 2/3 of the world's population. So around, you know, 65-70% are lactose intolerant. But if you look at the individual cultures, there's a wide variation. So as I mentioned earlier, Asians have a very high prevalence of lactose intolerance. Latinos, African Americans, but in Caucasians, so especially this kind of European descent, some of them actually have lactase permanence, so they still have the enzyme, because I think it's a culture where they've adapted to it. I think they kept a lot of cattle, so they have adapted to cow's milk protein, lactose, but other cultures haven't.
Right.
So just coming back to like the dairy allergy then, if someone comes to you and maybe they suspect that they might have a dairy allergy, what is your advice to them? Do you test them, or do you just basically tell them to like cease avoiding dairy and see if their symptoms resolve?
Yeah, that's a great question, because unfortunately there's no gold test for dairy allergy or any food allergies for that matter right now. Allergy testing is notoriously inaccurate. So for example, my daughter, she tested negative for dairy, and that's what threw everybody off, right? Because they're like, no, she doesn't have any food allergies. But of course they ran IgE panel They did the RAS test, so that's the skin prick test, where you prick the skin and then you put the allergens on top and you see the reaction. That again also just tests for IgE, the immediate type. So there's two types of tests for food allergies right now that are being used in conventional medicine, and that's the blood test, where you look for IgE levels to that food, or you have the RAS skin prick test, and both of those she tested negative, and yet she still had a milk allergy. And so the gold standard really is elimination and rechallenge. So you want to eliminate for about 3 weeks, and then during that time, of course, you know, the only thing that I think that's you may be missing when you avoid dairy is calcium. So you do need to be kind of conscious of how much calcium you're getting from other sources, but it's actually quite straightforward. You can get nutrients from other, if all the other nutrients in dairy you can get from other foods.
Right.
So if you eliminate dairy for 3 weeks and your symptoms go, and then you re-challenge and symptoms come back, I think that's the gold standard right now.
So that's good to keep in mind. But I want to talk about how, so just because someone doesn't have dairy allergy or isn't lactose intolerant, it doesn't automatically mean dairy is good for them, right? Because there's a lot more in dairy. And I was hoping to go through each one of those things, starting with the hormones that are naturally found in dairy. And this is, I'm not even talking about the hormones that are added, talking about just the ones naturally. So can you talk about those hormones and what effect they have on our body if you consume dairy? Sure.
Yeah, I think what people forget about dairy is that it's a food that cows have produced to feed the baby, right? So what's the intention there from nature? It's intended to grow a calf from, you know, 60 pounds to 400 pounds very quickly. And so it's going to contain growth stimulating hormones naturally, because that's what nature intended. And that's what people forget, is that yes, it does have all these other nutrients, but what else does it have in that package, right? It's lots and lots of hormones. And what really bugs me is when, you know, when I say, when they ask me, what do you drink instead of dairy? And I say soy, they're like, oh, what about the estrogen? And I say, what about the estrogen in cow's milk? Have you looked at that? You know, it's not talked about, but if you're going to compare it, there's a lot more estrogen in cow's milk compared to soy. And plus the estrogen that's in soy is actually a phytoestrogen, and they act very differently in the human body compared to just animal-based estrogen that our body actually can recognize as estrogen, right? And it's metabolized to the active estrone and estradiol. So there's that. And even if you're not talking about cows who are producing milk for dairy production while they're pregnant, because if you're looking at that situation, the amount of hormone is just, you know, it's enormous. So we've got the estrogen, we've got progesterone, we've got IGF-1, which is another growth stimulating hormone. And we know now there's association between increased IGF-1 level and certain types of cancer. And so, you know, it really underlies many aspects of chronic diseases, diabetes, acne, heart disease, cancer. It's a big concern for me, the hormones in dairy.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I love, just like you highlighted so well there, people are concerned about phytoestrogens when there's real estrogen in dairy. And I think that right there pretty much sums it up. So hormones aren't the only thing that's in milk that we should be concerned about. Another thing is commonly cited is the saturated fat that it contains. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, I think cheese is probably the commonest source of saturated fat in the Western world. And dairy, even the low fat milk, 20% of the calories is coming from fat. So it's not exactly low fat either. And saturated fat has been linked to heart disease. It's been linked to, fat in general is linked to insulin resistance, And also there's studies showing that it can actually affect our microbiome. So it plays into so many, so many different aspects of our health. I'm not against fat. I'm just against unhealthy fat in, you know, unhealthy proportions in our diet.
Yeah, and it's, I think people kind of forget that most of the national guidelines and all these health recommendations, they actually tell you to keep your saturated fat intake like as low as normal. They're not explicitly saying like, don't consume these animal products, don't consume cheese or dairy. But if you really think about it, like, where's the saturated fat coming from? It's, they're telling you to avoid the dairy.
Yeah, and then I think this is my theory anyway. It's not been proven in science, but fat is a vehicle for a lot of environmental toxins. So it's not just the fat anymore. You're not just consuming fat. It comes in a package of environmental toxins. And, you know, scientists use butter as a way to find where in the world environmental toxins are commonest found. So it's an indicator of how much fat soluble toxins there are in the environment. So it's concentrated in the fat as well. And that can have an impact. For example, it can increase oxidative stress and cause inflammation in our body. It can affect our hormones again. And so it's not just, oh, saturated fat is bad for you. It's the whole package again. And there's so many conflicting studies out there, right? The industries, I think, do a lot of studies showing you that fat is good for you and, you know, butter is back and all this stuff. And, you know, eggs are not bad for you. It doesn't raise cholesterol. But when you really dig down and look at the research, a lot of those are conducted biased. And, you know, it's really confusing for consumers and the general public.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So some people might just be confused that how are these environmental toxins even getting into these animals?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thought because many people don't make the connection there. But if you think about a cow grazing, even if it's like kind of grass-fed, right? Because a lot of people are like, oh no, but I only buy organic or grass-fed. Well, that doesn't really stop the fact that, you know, there's toxins in the rainwater and groundwater. So the grass that the cows are grazing on, that contains environmental toxins. But, you know, it's not a big deal for the cows because it's pretty low on the food. The grass is low on the food chain, so the concentration is pretty low. But how many pounds and pounds of that grass is the cow eating throughout the course of its lifetime? And that the toxins are bioaccumulating in the cow's body. And because a lot of these toxins, like PCBs, dioxins, they are lipophilic, so they like fat, they have an affinity to fat, they can accumulate in the fat of the animals. And studies have shown that dairy is one of the highest food sources of environmental toxins like PCB and dioxin. So it's actually, you know, if you look at it, it's actually, you can trace it all the way back down the food chain, back into the water, back into the soil, the grass. And so I don't really buy the notion that grass-fed is better. It may be better for other aspects, like, you know, the cows are not being fed inflammatory grains. But in terms of environmental toxins, it's still going to be the same.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you brought up bioaccumulation, because that's a topic that's just not talked about enough, and people don't, you know, connect the dots here, that if you're going to go eat, let's say, spinach or lettuce, it might still have a bit of minuscule environmental toxins, but you only consume those little bit. But when you consume a steak, let's say, or a glass of milk, all those toxins are not accumulated over the course of the animal's life. And you're basically consuming in such high amounts in just one meal.
Right, exactly. And it's like you're hitting the body with a super concentrated sauce. And we have detox mechanisms within our bodies, like the liver, the kidneys. We can get rid of certain amounts. So if you're consuming it at lower quantities, our bodies can cope. But if you're hitting it meal after meal, like 3-4 times a day with super concentrated quantities, then that's where your body is going to start screaming and say, oh, we can't cope anymore. And then when the toxins overspill, that's when you start to get health issues.
So what are some of the health issues that these like environmental toxins and like these organic pollutants, what are they associated with? Like they're more hormonal disorders, right?
Yes, mainly they're endocrine disruptors, but they've been associated with anything from, you know, infertility to endometriosis, PCOS, type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease, prostate issues, you name it. I mean, we're seeing it. We're seeing it in practice. Practicing doctors will see all of these health conditions rising. Infertility is rising. And unfortunately, we're not kind of coming back to look at the root causes. And there's like a unifying root cause, right, for all of these things.
It's difficult because I feel like Western medicine and a lot of like we learn to specialize and we learn to just look at one thing as the cause of the problem. And really it's like a systemic concern. And no one's really talking about the effect of, okay, there's environmental toxins, but it's hard to quantify that. It's hard to pinpoint a disorder on like one specific thing. And I think that's why it gets missed sometimes, because it's you can't be so reductionist in thinking that it's only one thing causing your problems, but it's the accumulation of all these different factors that's really doing harm.
Yeah, and then we forget that each organ has an impact on another. So if you affect someone's thyroid health, we might be impacting their sex hormones. But at medical school, I mean, I don't know how you guys are being taught, but when I was taught, over 20 years ago, we were taught in systems. So it's cardiovascular system and then respiratory system. I understand why we have to do that, because there's, it's difficult to study medicine, mm-hmm. right? It's so vast. But at the end of it, we should be able to unify everything and see the body working as one union.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's one thing that we haven't touched on that a lot of people don't think about and probably don't want to think about, that a lot of the milk that we buy today actually has pus in it. And if you could just touch on that.
Well, I don't know what else there's to say. It's got pus, and don't drink the stuff. Like that, there's so much. I mean, it's really sad when you think about it, the fact that there's so much pus. Like the cows are being pushed and treated in such a bad way that, a lot of them have infections, and there's like localized infection. That's where the pus is coming from. It's a horrible condition that, what we're doing to animals. That's one reason to really think about dairy, because, I didn't know until I looked into dairy from a scientific point of view, how dairy was made commercially. I didn't know that baby calves were taken away at birth from moms so that the mom could give us milk. It's so cruel. And as a mom, after I found out, I just could not continue to support that kind of practice anymore. But it's surprising how few people actually know. Like, and I speak to my friend, like, do you know how dairy is made? And they have no idea.
Yeah, because people just think cows are there to make you milk. Like, they don't think beyond that. They don't think about the fact that, why are cows making milk? How are they able to make it throughout, like, their lifetime, for the most part? Because that's not natural for any being to be making that much milk.
Right.
And what's happening to all those babies that are, coming out every year? Because if we're taking the milk, what's happening to them? And none of that, anyone puts it together, mostly because people just like go buy their carton of milk with a beautiful picture of a happy cow. And then they're like, oh, this came from a happy cow. This must be good milk. And that's it. And they don't think beyond that.
Right. Exactly. And, when I explain this to people, they're like, oh, but I love milk so much. It makes me feel happy. And, I'm like, well, have you thought about why it makes you happy? The chemicals in milk is converted to casomorphine in our bodies, and that's like a opiate, right? So if you have opiate addiction that everybody knows about, like codeine addiction, you're basically getting low doses of that, and that's why you're so hooked on dairy products. And that's why cheese is one of the hardest things to give up when I help people transition to a plant-based diet, because you're physiologically kind of craving that dopamine hit from these compounds.
Absolutely. And correct me if I'm wrong, these compounds are in the milk. So the baby calf keeps coming back to the cow to get more milk. So basically, as adults, we're having the same cravings that these baby calves are supposed to have. So there's you know, something that we're not thinking about, but there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny when you take a step back and you think, like, we are literally the only species in the world that drinks milk from another species. That in itself is really mind blowing, right? We're so used to living our lives and we don't want the status quo challenged. And I never wanted to. Like, I, you know, my life was good, right? I was practicing as a medical doctor, whatever. But it's very uncomfortable when you're challenged and you face these facts and you're like, is this for real? Like, why is this not talked about more? And then when you read the science, like, you realize that there really is so much truth to it, but then there are the forces that stand in the way of the truth getting out.
Yeah, it's just so much like how we've grown up to normalize these things. And like, you ask someone, it's like, well, would you drink human breast milk as an adult? And no one wants to. And no one would.
Yet we find it
acceptable to drink cow's breast milk, which is arguably way worse.
Yeah.
Right. And then so, I think there's an element of like, people just want to hear, like, they want to hear something that reinforces their habit, right? Because they want the eggs, they want their bacon, they want the creamer, they want that dairy-based ice cream. And so if they hear that, you know, this stuff is good, like the keto diet, then they gravitate towards that and they ignore, like, you know, what makes them uncomfortable and challenge their status quo.
Absolutely. So a lot of people are always concerned about calcium, which you briefly touched on above, because everyone is like, isn't dairy necessary for strong bones? So could you just touch on dairy, strong bones, calcium, and then also osteoporosis risk?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most entrenched misinformation in medicine, I think, you know, and it's still being taught, right? Like, even the USDA is still saying that children should drink 3 glasses of milk a day for strong bones and for nutrients. And there is just no science backing that up. There is probably some industry fueled science. There are studies showing that if you drink milk in adolescence, you may have higher bone density. But when you follow those children up later on, that effect drops off. And actually, it's not shown that these people have lower fracture risk. And ultimately, that's what we try to aim for, right? If you're trying to consume dairy for the calcium because you want strong bones, then the end result we want to see is that there's a reduction in fracture risk, but there isn't. It's not been shown in any studies. And in fact, there's a very large study done in Sweden that was published in 2015 in the BMJ that show the opposite. So this is a really large study following men and women for, I think, up to 20 years. So it's a long-term study as well. And it showed that women who consumed more dairy actually had increased risk of hip fractures and an increased risk of mortality, surprisingly. And in men, they didn't show an increased risk of hip fracture. That might be the difference in, you know, hormone profile between men and women. But the increased mortality really surprised everybody, because it's like, where's that coming from? And I think the authors proposed that it could be because of D-galactose, so another sugar present in milk, and that could be causing oxidative stress and inflammation. And what they showed was that there was a dose-dependent risk to drinking milk. So the more you drank, the higher your risk.
So galactose, that's not something we usually have in our diets, right? It just comes...
No, it's mainly from milk, I believe.
Yeah, so if our body is not normally supposed to be digesting that, I'm guessing it probably won't do the body good to be adding that to our diet.
Yeah, exactly.
No, super alarming. So say if someone stops consuming dairy, they obviously still need calcium. What do you find, in your opinion, are the best sources of calcium to add into your diet if you have, if you're not already?
Plant-based sources of calcium is wonderful. And there's so many, I mean, there's calcium in pretty much everything. That's just in different amounts, right? And they're presented in a way that our bodies actually can recognize and digest and absorb better. So they're being shown to, you know, the calcium in greens is more bioavailable for us. And there's a really interesting study. It's not a great, a big study, but they looked at Vietnamese nuns, and they are vegans, basically. And they looked at their bone density compared to people who consumed milk in the West. And the nuns basically had predominantly, very vegetable-based, like greens, plant-based diet. And their bone density is actually the same as somebody who consumed milk in the West. And I think when they measured when they estimated how much calcium they're getting through the diet, it's in the range of like 600 milligrams a day, which is way lower than what all these dietary guidelines say that we, you know, in the US, they actually say that we need to be getting 1000 milligrams. And I think that what's interesting about how much calcium you need is it's also based on what else you're eating, right? Because if you have a very acid forming diet, like very meat and dairy, cheese based, that the byproducts of digesting and metabolizing those foods is that there's a lot of acid formed in your body, which our bodies then need to neutralize in order to maintain that consistent pH in our blood. And the way it does that is that pulling out minerals from different pieces to try and counteract that increased acidity. And so I think in those scenarios, you probably do need more calcium in order to maintain the same bone mass. Whereas, you know, in somebody who is eating a diet that's kind of more alkali based, you may not need so much calcium. And I think the number one most important thing that people don't talk about when it comes to bone health is exercise. So, you know, weight bearing exercise is so important for bone health. You could be taking all the calcium supplements or, you know, drinking 3 glasses of milk, but if you're not getting out there and doing exercise, you're not going to put the calcium is not going to end up in your bone. Let's put it that way. It's probably going to be, you know, pushed out through the body, or it may be even worse, like calcifying your blood vessels.
Yeah, yes. No, absolutely. Because I think the exercise part is super crucial that a lot of people don't realize, especially as you get older, like, you know, a bit of weight bearing exercise is super important for your healthy bones. It's not just the calcium. And it's not just the calcium for healthy bones anyway. You need other minerals like phosphorus and vitamin D.
Exactly.
Somehow they don't get any media attention, but calcium does.
Right. I know. It's really weird. I mean, calcium definitely is important, and we definitely need that minimum amount we need for bone health and actually other aspects of metabolism. But it's not the only thing that you need to consider.
Yeah. So an easy switch for people to make is to just completely replace their dairy milk with the plant-based milk. So whether it's soy or almond or cashew. So what are your thoughts on using these fortified milks as a source of calcium? And if what would be your first choice if you had to pick one?
Yeah, so I think there's this misnomer that we must get our calcium from milk, right? So a lot of people when they transition, it's like, what's the best milk for my toddler? And I'm like, well, actually milk, you don't want to be getting the majority of your calcium from a plant-based milk, because most of that calcium is fortified, is added to, it's not naturally there. I mean, almond is probably the highest in natural calcium, but the rest of the milks they're fortified. I don't have an issue with that if there's no way you can add calcium into your diet from whole foods form. But my preferred way when I counsel my clients and patients is to incorporate more greens. So seeds, nuts and seeds are great sources of calcium as well. Like sesame seed is fantastic. So a spoonful of tahini, have lots of greens. And with that as well, it's not just calcium. You're getting like the whole host of what Mother Nature has designed for us to take in with the calcium that will help us to use the calcium better, and all the antioxidants, all the fiber. I would say, you know, use the plant-based milk as a beverage that you like the drink of, but don't rely on it as a calcium source unless you really can't meet your calcium requirement from whole foods form.
Right, absolutely. So whey protein tends to get a lot of attention these days, especially for muscle building and stuff. I know when I consumed whey protein, like my digestive system was out of whack and I had a lot of acne. So could you just touch on that? Like, because a lot of people would be like, oh, I consume like grass-fed isolate whey protein, so it's okay. But if you could talk about that, that would be helpful.
Yeah. So there's no doubt that whey is a great stimulator of mTOR, right? So it's going to stimulate growth. And that's why bodybuilders love it. But that's why you had issues with acne, for example. If you stimulate a growth enzyme, it's going to stimulate growth and it's going to mess up our hormonal system. So when you stimulate IGF-1, it's going to throw off it's going to affect your insulin resistance. And there's a lot of evidence linking dairy consumption, for example, with dairy. It's to do with the hormones, but it's also to do with the fact that mTOR is activated.
Absolutely. And what about casein? Because that's the other type of protein found in dairy.
Yes, very difficult to digest. And there's actually links between that protein and autism spectrum disorders. So it can affect behavior. And casein is also being shown to stimulate mTOR. So I think it's the protein studied by Dr. Colin Campbell in the China study. And it's a very powerful activator of mTOR again. So we're talking about, we don't want to be activating growth when we're adults, right? We're not growing anymore. So when you activate growth excessively and unnaturally, what is growing? Probably tumors, not great things. You want to be maintained when you're an adult, maintaining a good level of mTOR, because it kind of prevents aging, but you don't want excessive activation of mTOR.
Fair enough. So what about some of these, like, there's so many different healthier types of milks. You've kind of touched on like the grass-fed and the organic dairy and how inherently there are still concerns with these, but now we're hearing about things like A2 milk and lactose-free milk. What are your thoughts on these alternative products?
Yeah, so lactose-free milk is just such a gimmick. I mean, yes, it may help you if you have the symptoms of lactose intolerance like diarrhea, bloating, but the milk protein is still there. So those proteins we just talked about, they're still there. So they're still going to be stimulating the mTOR. They're still going to be stimulating IGF-1. So you're still going to have, and there's still the hormones present. They haven't gotten rid of that. So pretty much everything we just talked about is still going to be present apart from lactose. So you may not have the diarrhea, you may not have the bloating, but you're going to be still carrying the side effects of milk from drinking. Yeah.
The way I see lactose-free milk is you're basically taking the signaling system out. So your body now can't tell that it doesn't like milk. So now all the bad stuff is happening in the background. The only difference is now you don't know that your body doesn't like milk.
Yeah.
It's a good way to think of it.
Yeah. And there's something like quite dangerous I'm seeing out in public, and it's not their fault. It's just, I think there's, lack of education awareness. A lot of moms telling other moms, oh, if your child has a dairy allergy, give them lactose-free milk. And it's like, no, the milk protein that's triggering the immune response is still there. Please don't give them lactose-free milk. So that's my thought on lactose-free milk. And the A2, I think there's the proposal is that the protein is easier for the human body to digest. I don't know that there's very much evidence for that. But yeah, again, we're going to be, the lactose is still going to be there to cause your diarrhea and bloating, and all the hormones and the IGF problem, the mTOR activation is still all going to be there even with A2 milk anyway.
Yeah, and so, I believe it's genetically modified too, I believe, isn't it? So that's kind of alarming just to think about as it is.
Right, exactly.
you have talked about mTOR a couple of times and then the connection with cancer, but some people who are not medical students listening to this won't know what mTOR is. So if you could just briefly just talk about what that is so someone could just put that together.
So mTOR is actually the master regulator of growth in all the cells. And it's kind of upregulated when we are going through periods of growth. So in babies, infancy, childhood, it's activated. And, you know, this is through a process called epigenetics, where, you know, our body can put methyl caps and things like that on genes to stop transcription, so to silence it or to activate it. And so mTOR is hugely activated when we need growth in the body and we need repair. And then it's silenced when we reach adulthood, and it's kind of activated when we need to repair, and then it's mostly silenced. So there's like a Goldilocks balance of mTOR in adulthood, where you want enough so that your body repairs itself and you retain your youthful appearance, but you don't want too much where it's, you know, you're just activating growth in, for example, precancerous lesions. So that's what mTOR essentially is.
All right. So obviously we've touched on quite a few conditions that are associated with MELK, from like cancer you mentioned, acne, heart disease. One that I'm not sure how much research there is to back it yet, but there's a bit of an association between type 1 diabetes and MELK consumption, I think as an infant or perhaps in the mother. I don't know too much about this. I was just wondering if you could maybe tell us what you know.
Yeah, so what I know is that I think it's linked to a bacteria called paratuberculosis. So I forget the full name now. It's a mycobacteria in the same class as TB. But it's basically something that infects a lot of cows. So it's a problem rampant in the dairy industry, actually. And, you know, they will normally need to treat the cows because they become diseased. But it does pass through into the milk, and there's some suggestion that there's possibly molecular mimicry between this bacteria and the proteins in our pancreas. And so when our immune system sees paratuberculosis in our body because we've ingested milk, it starts to attack it. But in the process, it's producing an attack also on the pancreas because it's similar in molecular structure. Now, I don't think that it's been proven. It's not like, you know, fully science backed, but there's a suggestion that that may be one of the causes. And there's some small scale study showing that out of the people with type 1 diabetes, they have a higher incidence of carriage of the antibody towards paratuberculosis. So possibly their bodies mounted an attack. And I think that with a lot of these things, there's probably like a time window when, if you were exposed that during that critical time, that's when you develop the disease. And that's why not everybody who drinks milk develops. And there's also probably a genetic predisposition as well. But it's definitely proposed to be linked to autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes.
That makes a lot of sense. You had a while back mentioned constipation, and that seems to be a very common problem these days that people go to the doctor to talk about. So how does dairy play a role in constipation?
I think it's on several different parts. So if you have like that low-grade delayed immune response, then your gut could be becoming inflamed from dairy ingestion, and that could be slowing down gut transit time. And one of the things that I always have moms try when they bring their children in with constipation is that trial of elimination of dairy, and that gets rid of constipation in so many people, and also people with in adulthood with IBS, gut related symptoms. So much of that is related to dairy, and it's difficult to know whether it's the dairy protein itself, whether it's the lactose, or whether it's the toxins that's, you know, it's coming with. But Dairy elimination is really important step when you consider constipation.
That makes sense. And another big one, like one of the biggest killers right now, is heart disease. And you had briefly mentioned the role of dairy. Is it mostly coming from the high saturated fat that's in dairy, or are there also other factors in dairy?
I think there are many different layers. Saturated fat definitely can play a role in increasing plaque formation, but we also need to remember that we're now increasingly seeing that heart disease is an inflammatory condition, right? So what triggers that plaque to be damaged, and then you got the repair process leading to thrombus formation. That's the trigger to an acute heart attack. And we touched on that when we talked about the Swedish study, where they showed that there was an increased mortality rate with those who drank more milk. And they said that it could be because of the deep galactose causing oxidative stress. So oxidative stress is a really important underlying factor for a lot of different chronic diseases. And, you know, when we whittle down to the root cause, oxidative stress and inflammation underlies things like type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. So I think that's another factor at play as well.
Makes sense. We've talked about a lot of potential conditions that can be associated with dairy. Is there any that we may not have asked about that you think can also be caused by dairy? Or have we touched on all of the important ones?
No, I think it's basically most of the chronic diseases that we see out there. And so I think that, you know, really children and adolescent is where we need to be really focusing on with dairy as well, because when we change what they eat, we change the trajectory of their health for the rest of their lifespan, right? So it's really important to get to them. And in a way, when you have, acne in an adolescent is rapidly rising, it's like an epidemic now. And you know, when you realize that, you know, it could be the dairy driving the mTOR and then changing the hormonal balance, you could be impacting on this person's fertility rates, their risk of endometriosis, PCOS, and cardiovascular disease rate and cancer down the line. You're doing a huge, tremendous amount of, change and benefit to this person's life when you actually tackle that issue.
That makes sense. I have a really quick question about infants and milk options. So if the parent is not able to breastfeed for whatever reasons they may have, and you're not recommending dairy, so what are the options that they should think about?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think it definitely needs to be a discussion between the person and their pediatrician, because there are different factors determining which one is the best. But milk bank is actually a good option. And, you know, you can find clean ones that they screen for, like contaminants and diseases and things like that. So that could be an option, like donated human milk, or it will be like a soy-based formula for now.
Okay. We have three questions that we ask every guest at the end of the episode. So the first question is, what is your favorite plant-based meal?
Meal?
Yeah.
My favorite plant-based meal, I think it have to be a black bean and sweet potato taco.
That sounds delicious.
Sounds delicious. Second question, what is one kitchen item you wouldn't be able to live without?
My Vitamix, because I make my plant-based milk and all my sauces, vegan cheese, everything with it.
That's great. And what is one final piece of advice or takeaway you would like to leave for our listeners?
You are in more control of your health destiny than you know. Take an interest in nutrition, take an interest in how you live your life and your lifestyle, because that can have impact on your health destiny way down the line.
Beautifully said. If our listeners would like to connect with you, find out more about you, where can they find you and reach you?
So I have a website, it's www.platefulhealth.com. And then I'm also very active on Instagram, and my handle there is platefulhealth.
Well, awesome. We'll put all that in the show notes so people can find you. Well, thank you so much for being on
our
podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to the Plant Prescription Podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it, and hopefully this inspires you to take steps towards making changes so you live a longer, happier, and healthier life.
You can also follow us on Instagram, where we share nutrition, health, and fitness content, along with recipes. Our Instagram handles can be found in the description of this episode. Please make sure to subscribe so you don't miss on any upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed this, we would love it if you left us a positive review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Please also make sure to share this with any family or friends who may benefit. Thank you so much for listening.
Also, be sure to eat plenty of plants and see you next week.